Age of Radio.
One of the things I love about making beer is when I can make a beautiful, crystal clear beer. Don't get me wrong, last week we talked about hazy IPAs, and when they're supposed to be hazy, I want them that way. But when I want to make a lager, I want it to be bright. So we're talking to Jamie Carmichael, and we're going to talk to him about making clear beer on Homebrewing DIY.
Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And welcome back to Homebrewing DIY, the podcast that takes on the do-it-yourself aspect of homebrewing. Gadgets, contraptions, and parts, this show covers it all. On this week's show, we're talking with Jamie Carmichael. Jamie is the technical sales director for Murphy & Son Limited. They make finings and brewing equipment and products for the brewing industry, and he's based here in the United States, and we're going to talk to him about techniques to making very clear beer. So I'm excited. Stick around for the interview. But first, I'd like to thank all of our patrons over at Patreon. It's because of you that this show can come to you week after week. Head on over to patreon.com/homebrewingDIY. I first thing want to do is mention a couple of patrons who have now given at any amount. So I'd like to throw a shout out to Nivik. Nivik has given at the $1 level, so thank you very much. And Chris George also gave at the $1 level, so thank you very much. Just note, I mentioned this last week, I did change my levels on Patreon. You can now get access to the RSS feed and a set of stickers for only $1. So head on over to homebrewingdiy.beer and give a dollar, and you can be listening to an early ad-free episode. If you're a patron, you're listening to the show on a Tuesday right now versus waiting until Thursday, and there are no commercials. So if commercials bother you, which they do bother me, that's one way to get it commercial-free. So I'd like to thank all of our patrons. Another way to support the show, you can give one time over at Ko-fi, that's ko-fi.com/homebrewingDIY. And there you can do a one-time donation to the show, and all of those donations as well help keep us up and rolling. So thank you very much. Another way to support the show is to write us a review. Head over to podchaser.com, or if you're listening to us on Apple, just scroll to the bottom, leave us a 5-star review. That really helps as well. The last way to support the show is head on over to our website, homebrewingdiy.beer. And there you can use our sponsor banners. So if you're going to buy homebrew supplies from Adventures in Homebrewing, it's a short trip to just go click on the link, and doing so keeps your prices all the same. If you have a special deal, still stays the same, but it lets them know that we sent you, and then they there in turn support the show. We also have other banners such as Brewfather and brewinabag.com or the Brew Bag. And clicking on those links is also going to support us. Not a ton going on in my brewery right now. I actually was a little sick last week. I apparently got the show out, but was unable to do the blog post. I was held up in bed. I didn't have COVID-19. I just had a really bad toothache, and it was a pretty miserable experience. And but I am feeling better this week, so pretty excited about that. But yeah, it's been a rough time down here in the Wilson house. So, but excited to get this week's episode out. Also excited to possibly get a brew day in this week. I have a few beers I want to brew. I want to brew a Saison, and I also want to do a hazy IPA, just because the show last week where I talked to Brandon Snaps gave me some ideas of how I want to change up my hazy IPA so that, you know, can maybe get a more consistent product. I feel like the hazy IPA has been my white whale. So we'll get through it. Well, let's dive into the episode. Let's talk to Jamie Carmichael, and we're going to talk about techniques for making clear beer. I'd like to welcome Jamie Carmichael. Jamie's a technical sales director for Murphy and Son, which is a what would you say they do? They sell brewing supplies, right? Is that what you would say?
Yeah, Jamie? We make you know, some brewing supplies, some beer agents, and you know, we supply a bit of everything. We've been in the allied industries, as they call it, for commercial breweries since 1887. We've got a long back catalog.
That's a real long time.
Yeah. It's, and in that time, you know, it's still kind of in, you know, the original location, which is a gravity fed kind of brewery from, you know, the mid 19th century, you know, in the Midlands of the UK. So that's our headquarters. It's a small company, and we kind of focus on, you know, supplying breweries with, you know, beer processing aids and, you know, almost kind of most things that you need to make good beer.
Well, Jamie is the United States Technical Sales Director, and you're originally from Scotland, and you've been studied brewing, distilling, and then you've also worked in as a, you've been a home brewer, you've worked as a professional brewer. Let's start with how you started home brewing and how that turned into an entire education for you. How did that all happen?
Yeah, I mean, I left school. I didn't really know what I wanted to do in Edinburgh, Scotland. And if you didn't know what you wanted to do and you needed a job, you went and, you know, you worked in a bar. And eventually I kind of saved up some money and bought a plane ticket. And I kind of flew over to the United States for a little bit. This would have been 2005, 2006. And I traveled around and I, you know, ended up in San Francisco and I visited Anchor Steam Brewery. We did the tour and it was really, you know, a great tour around the brewery there, and had a couple of beers at the end. And one of the brewers came out, and this was kind of before the time of, you know, official kind of meet the brewers. And he, yeah, a scruffy guy wearing kind of overalls, and he came behind the tasting bar and poured himself a beer and answered a couple of questions and then went back to work. And I thought that was kind of cool. And then I ended up in Australia, and homebrewing is pretty big in Australia. They sell the, you know, these Cooper's homebrew kits in the supermarkets. You can go to the supermarket, you can buy your groceries, and you can put in a homebrew kit, you know. And we, you know, I was in my 20s and living with this guy, we bought one of these kits. We went in it together and, you know, poured this syrup and some water into a bucket and added some yeast and thought we were amazing. and I kind of connected the dots between what I'd just done, you know, I'd caused it to happen, and then, you know, this memory from a kind of few months earlier at Anchor Steam Brewery with this kind of guy who got to drink beer at work, and I said, hey, that's a job for me. I think I've decided my vocation in life. And you know, when you grow up in Scotland, you know, you go to high school and, you know, tertiary, you know, university education is free. And they give you, when you're leaving school, they give you this really big book of all the universities in Scotland with all the courses, the UCAS book. And you can look through pages and pages of this massive tome of education. And I remembered, you know, kind of 6 years later, that when I was kind of had been reading this book, that there was a course in my hometown on brewing and distilling, you know, at this university called Heriot Watt. You know, so I was kind of, by that stage, I was living in kind of Queensland. I was working in this resort in a pool bar, you know, one of these ones that people swim up to. I was kind of living up there, you know, living in a van, and going to, you know, this is before, you know, kind of smartphones. I'd kind of go to the internet cafe and filled out this application form, and, you know, kind of had to, you know, email my dad to go into the attic to find paperwork and, you know, apply to go to university in Scotland, you know, to go and study brewing and distilling. And, you know, absolutely loved it. You know, if they didn't, you know, make me graduate, I'd potentially still be there. It was, you know, pretty pleasant lifestyle.
And then after that, you went right into pro brewing, or were you home brewing the whole time?
We home brewed at university. It was splendid because the system was, they had this old kind of pilot brewery, you know, made nice beer, and they got donated kind of bags of malt from, like, Crisp Malting was one I remember, and then they had some stuff from, you know, from Vireman. Some bags there, and you'd go, and I can't remember the name of the calculator at the time. This would have been kind of 2006, you know. We all started homebrewing together, you know, the 10 brewing students there were in the year, and we'd kind of go down to the pilot brewery and speak to Graham McKernan, who was the pilot brewery kind of lead down there. And, you know, you'd have to find him, you know, quite often. He was maybe walking around the block smoking a kind of rolled up cigarette or something like that, and you'd go find him and get him to open up the malt room, and you'd weigh out your grains and, you know, find some hops in the pilot lab and kind of mill them up, and, you know, go take a bag of milled grain and put it in your, you know, in your locker, and then take it home in the bus. So, you know, we were kind of home brewing all through university. You know, occasionally we did step to go and buy some materials from a homebrew store. It was kind of nothing like it is now. And, you know, if you wanted to drink beer, you know, even not even as kind of ambitious as the beers you can get commercially now, the only way to drink them was you had to kind of make them yourself. So, you know, the first kind of hoppy beers and big beers, or, you know, imperial stouts that, you know, we could get and drink in Scotland in 2005, you know, we were making our own, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing the amount of variety of beer you can get at a brewery today as compared to even 15 or 20 years ago, right? And that's a global thing. It's not, I know we talk about it here in the United States, like, oh, microbrewery is a whole thing. But even in the UK, for a long time, you know, it was a lot of this very much the same styles over and over again, and now you can pretty much get any beer there, right?
Yeah. I mean, there was Real Ale. I mean, Real Ale had done well. You know, there's a campaign for Real Ale, Camera, which, you know, they kind of say themselves, they kind of, you know, they completed their mission. You know, so, you know, with the home brewing, we would go to Real Ale festivals. You know, and there's a variety there, you know, there's certainly, you know, a spectrum. So there is that, yeah, and potentially kind of German beer bars, but, you know, right now it's amazing. You know, I live in New England, and you can go to a gas station and be overwhelmed with choice. It's really fantastic.
It really is. But, and even though you're in New England, and I'm sure you like her because you sell to breweries, you're probably living in a land of New England IPA, just like the rest of the country. But I brought you on the show for a specific reason, and I want to talk about brilliantly beautiful, clear beer. And and so I personally, you know, when a style is meant to be a hazy style, a Hefeweizen or a New England style or hazy IPA, you know, I go for that style. But for the most part, when I make other types of beer, a blonde ale, a lager, you know, a standard West Coast IPA, I'm looking for that brilliantly clear beer. To me, if it's meant to be a clear style, I want it to be as crystal clear as possible. And I'd love to talk to you about some tips and tricks that you would give anybody at a homebrew level on making your beer as clear as possible. All the way, and I think we should start with maybe process and some things that you could do as part of your process to really just make sure that you're setting yourself up right to get the clearest beer possible.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a fining expert now, but you know, I've done brewing science and I've worked in breweries, and you know, finings are an aid. You know, they're not the silver bullet. You know, you do need raw material selection, and you do need a you know, the process in place, and the finding is just give you that, you know, help you get that last mile. So, you know, we're very lucky. I mean, you know, sometimes what I say with my position here, you know, because I mostly work with commercial breweries, is, you know, commercial brewing of beer in the United States is quite often they're brewing kind of English styles on, you know, German equipment with kind of American enthusiasm. So it can be a little bit kind of complicated to get them into the actual vessels. But you know, for homebrew side, you know, the raw materials which are available, you know, are on par with, you know, what we said with the kind of craft beer earlier. The you know, some really fantastic raw materials out there, and it does start with the malt. You know, the British style was using a kind of very well modified malt that, you know, required, you know, not much processing by the brewer. So what you saw was it was kind of easy to kind of break up. There was kind of very little kind of protein left. There was no requirement for a kind of protein rest during the mash. So, you know, so absolutely using a well quality, well modified malt. Or if you are choosing, you know, to brew more of a German style, that you understand the additional processing requirements that you need to put in place upstream in the mash. And then through to boiling, you know, the most critical thing for the coagulation of proteins is a very vigorous boiling. It's, you know, a lot of it is there's the heat involved, but the actual action, you know, the kind of turbulence in the boil is one of the things which, you know, really augments the coagulation of the proteins.
Yeah, so I'd like to ask some questions there just a bit. So, you know, personally, there's all kinds of debates out there right now where it's like, should you boil hard? Should you boil just barely rolling? And obviously, I think it also depends on the type of beer you're trying to make. But, you know, for example, you talk about the coagulation of the proteins and you know, boiling hard helps that happen faster. Is it, you know, a more vigorous boil makes it so that those proteins coagulate more? Or if you have a slower boil, it's harder to achieve? Is that the science behind that?
Yeah. I know it's quite late over here. The name escapes me, but the brewer, you know, from Hoegaarden in Belgium, who kind of moved down to Texas, I believe his trick was for maintaining a stable haze was just to kind of simmer the boiling wort. Whereas, you know, if you want to get those really big flots of the hot break and, you know, kickstart the formation of the cold break, you know, it's, you know, the mechanical vigor. I think when I homebrew, you know, I've only recently re-entered kind of homebrewing world recently, you know, prior to this, I was either working in a brewery where, you know, you would take home, you know, kind of wonky labeled beer or underfill beer, so I was kind of self-sufficient for beer from work. And then after that, I was on the road quite a lot, so I didn't really kind of care to to homebrew very much, you know. So this is, it's only been a kind of last year since kind of COVID. I think it's fantastic what's happened with the changes, but you know what I think, what a homebrewer calls a vigorous boil is probably more vigorous than what you can get in a commercial setting. Yeah, I see. And if I'm, you know, I think when I started, I was like, I need a vigorous boil. So I put the burner up, you know, real high and burnt it for 60 minutes. And I think I had an evaporation of like 15%. And I think, you know, I think what you're looking for is, you know, 5, maybe 10%, you know, wouldn't go lower than 5. So you, it's one of the things which, just because of the geometries and the volumes involved with home brewing, that you can kind of over egg it a little bit. What I do now is I think I can't even remember the name of the brewery I worked in where I picked this up, but I do a vigorous kind of 10 minutes, kind of 40 minute kind of simmer stage, where as long as it's moving, and then the final kind of 10 minutes is a vigorous again. That's my strategy.
Awesome. And in doing so, you mentioned that it kind of kickstarts the cold break with getting that agitation going. And
it definitely, you know, we've got some very good data on the hot break for the turbulence in it. And then a lot of what I specialize now in is the application of kind of carrageenan based finding agents, which mostly work on the cold break side. And it's a finickety science. It does involve, you know, if you have hot break carryover, because you've had a poor, less vigorous boil, you know, the inclusion of hot break will be a detriment to the formation of the cold break.
And then it's a lot harder, and we're going to assume, I want to assume that people listening to this are brand new homebrewers. And so if you don't have a good formation of your cold break, what ends up happening is that you still have a lot of proteins in suspension as you rack your beer into your fermenter, right?
Yeah. So I think the cold break is, you know, it's quite often kind of classified as being protein. And it is mostly protein. The protein that we talk about, it is kind of similar to kind of gluten, you know, which is kind of a kind of famous aggregate of kind of protein. It's more the storage protein from malt, which is hordene. It's not digested very well. It isn't, you know, it's quite big and it coagulates. But along with the protein, there is a sugar, which is also, you know, one of these kind of bete noirs of homebrewers, which is kind of beta-glucan. So that's tied up in there. So it's maybe 50% protein, 25% beta-glucan, and the other kind of 25% is polyphenols.
In all things that are going to be a detriment to the clarity of your beer, right?
Yeah. So what we generally say is, as the strategy is, you want to be removing, you know, as much of that particulate material at every stage of the process. So, you know, we didn't talk too much about lightering or, you know, kind of mash tun wort separation technology. You know, we can move past that, you know, so it is vigorous boiling. You know, I think a lot of brewers are kind of figuring out a system where they either kind of have a whirlpool or some kind of screen to hold back the any kind of hot material and, you know, tube or hot break. And then onwards, most of the time what you see with kind of commercial brewing is that the you know, the carrageenan and the kettle finings are, you mostly see them kind of working in the fermenter. It's obviously a little bit different with home brewing if you're using an immersion cooler, because all the break will sediment out in that vessel.
And then let's talk about, you know, different types of you know, things you can do in the fermentation side to help with clarity?
So obviously, I think a lot with home brewing, you know, we're buying either kind of liquid pitch from those providers, or it's a dry pitch. Dead yeast doesn't flocculate very well. So if you're, you know, that is a main problem, or can be a big problem with kind of pitching unviable cells. And, you know, we do see like sometimes a range, you know, with all these breweries, there's different expertise in yeast handling, and there can be, you know, some, a proportion of kind of dead yeast going in, which will cause a haze problem. You know, one of the things breweries will do is kind of remove the break. You know, the cold break will settle over the course of the first 24 hours, 48 hours during the, you know, during the kind of growth phase of the yeast. So, you know, if you do have a kind of cylindrical kind of homebrew setup, it is possible to remove the cold break from the fermenter. For the most part, you know, as long as you kind of pitch nice, healthy yeast, you know, kind of 90% viability, 95%, 98%, you should be fine. And then most of the, you know, the agents that we work with happen at the end. One of the reasons I kind of said I didn't do any home brewing when I was kind of traveling, not that I didn't want to, was because I didn't have any cooling. And I was so determined that I wasn't going to do any home brewing unless I could attemperate it, cool it, keep it in cold storage. That I didn't do anything. And then I opted to buy a couple of chest freezers with thermostats to run some yeast studies. They went phenomenally expensive, because at during the toilet paper rush. But in terms of kind of non kind of chemical agents, that you can do for really bright, clear beer is cold. You know, so I maintain, you know, quite a cool temperature throughout fermentation. Cold crash is the kind of terminology that, you know, most folk use for that point at the end of fermentation, where, you know, you go up and you put the you turn the cold on higher. You know, you make it, I generally set it to, you know, around about freezing, or the, you know, water freezing point. And then I leave it, you know, and get as much yeast off, and then typically kind of transfer it off the sedimented yeast that's kind of dropped out because of the cold. Most other things have started to drop out, and I'll transfer it to a new, fresh, clean vessel. And I'll continue to store it cold. And it's usually at that point, if there's any beer finings, I'm kind of putting in, I'll add them in there. Findings. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I was gonna say let's talk about findings now. I think that, you know, because there are some hot side findings out there as well, but let's talk about your cold side findings and kind of what those look like.
So there's two main ones, and they come with kind of auxiliary finding agents, you know, which if you want what. You know, what they call like a button bright or a very polished beer. You know, the one which, you know, we've sort of made since 1860. We bought Savills, who had made Isinglass since 1860, and we still continue to make and sell to this, you know, some of their original customers from 1860 Isinglass. Isinglass is, you know, what we call like a piscine derived fining agent. It comes from fish swim bladders. Historically, I think the fish of choice was sturgeon. It's a very large fish, and the swim bladders are pretty big. They don't come from sturgeon anymore. I think it's too expensive. They come from you know, kind of species of catfish from India, which have the swim bladders are smaller. Generally, if you're sourcing swim bladders, you want to look for estuarine fish because they need the greatest size of swim bladder to cope with the changing density of water owing to the mix of fresh and salt water in that region. So that they're sourced and it's produced into a liquid, which is still very popular for the clarification of cask ale. You know, when I started with the company, I'd obviously heard of it. It's a fine agent that works very well, but I did ask how anyone ever thought to use it. What it transpires is that, you know, swim bladder is, you know, it's basically a pouch, you know, so it's a there's not a lot to it. It's kind of 98% collagen, which is the same sort of protein that is in the skin. You know, there's not a lot else to it, you know, so it was essentially used previously as a, you know, a storage vessel for beer, you know, because there was a little bag. And I think from that, they were able to ascertain that it had another property. It does this, you know, the isinglass is a collagen. It's a very long molecule. You, in the process of making isinglass from what they call fish maws, you know, you dissolve into a liquid and you tease apart these collagen molecules. And in a similar way to most fine agents, they work as flocculants. And you know, the theory goes is that, you know, many large molecules or particles will fall faster than, many small ones, to do with the fact that they're just kind of reducing the drag. There's some other kind of fluid dynamics going on there, which means it works very well. But that's kind of what happens. So the collagen has an unusual amino acid called hydroxyproline, which carries with it a slight positive charge. Yeast normally carries a slight negative charge to it. So when you add it into a solution, you might have kind of one long collagen molecule and it will kind of adhere to many yeast cells. And they all drop out and they will form these kind of flocks. It happens very quickly. If you test it, you know, you put a drop in a, you know, a kind of pint glass size volume of beer. And within a couple of hours, you're seeing it settle and drop to the bottom.
And so if you were brewing at home, what product would you use for a fining?
That is a very good one. The stuff that we use, it, because it's a piscine derived, it's got a limited shelf life. It works brilliantly. The other one, which I meant to mention, was the silica based ones. So quite often they have a kind of more ready to use shelf stable. So I do use this one as well. So these are ones, there's a few different brand names out there. They generally work in a similar way. So there's a kind of colloidal silicon solution. It works slightly differently than what the isinglass does. The isinglass comes in this kind of big long molecule that's already formed. And as it goes in, it, you know, attracts yeast and it drops to the bottom and it pulls some other stuff out at the same time. The silica based ones, you know, our one's called Super F. There's, you know, a few others. It's a colloidal particle. So that particle is actually about a thousandth the size of a yeast cell. So very small. What you're relying on when you add it, it kickstarts a little reaction due to the changing pH, and it will start to form a gel in the vessel, a very kind of light gel, and it has the same effect. It works pretty well, and I think for like a homebrew setting, if things aren't moving very much, it will it's a pretty good way of doing it. You can get, you know, I brew a lot of lager, and I generally use that for lager in a homebrew setting. The reason, you know, there's a two of them, apart from the origin, is that the, you know, our main kind of customers for the Isinglass are the cask ale breweries in the UK. If you've worked in a cask ale brewery, or you've drunk it, if you've seen a firkin from the UK, they're beat up, because, you know, it basically relies on a brewer pouring into the vessel, into this firkin, with some Isinglass and hammering a shive in and rolling it to the brewery door and putting it in the back of a van, and the van rolls it down the street and drops it into a cellar, and, you know, the landlord of the pub rolls it from the cellar to the still agent. It moves around a lot, you know, so the silica based fining agents don't stand up to being moved around. You know, they drop bright once, maybe twice, but after that they start to disintegrate the sediment. The Isinglass finings can actually improve because they're so sticky, so you see the opposite effect. So different markets, different beer styles require different types of finings. And then, you know, there's auxiliary fining agents you can get as well, which, you know, just help to adjust a few leftover particles, but that's a level I don't even go to at home sometimes. You usually get with either of those below 1 EBC, which is the haze rating for beer that we use.
And then, so you know, to sum up what we've talked about already, obviously process and ingredient selection is really important when it comes to the types of, like, if you're going to make a clear beer, you got to plan for it, right? Mm-hmm. You want to select the right ingredients. And then once you get into the fermenter, just cold conditioning and getting it cold is going to help you get the bulk of the material that's floating around in there, the proteins and the yeast. Move it over to another vessel and then still store it cold and then fine it at that point, right?
Yeah. I mean, the guy that taught me to make beer, you know, everything is sat for 2 weeks at minus 2 centigrade, which is what, kind of 30 Fahrenheit. And it was a big deal to have it released earlier than that. I kind of sway a little bit now, especially with some of the hoppier ales, but they tend not to be the bright ones. Usually if I'm making a bright beer, I'm worried he's going to come up my garden path and tell me off potentially if I do it for less than 2 weeks. The other thing, which I don't know if you're going to come to this, I think, you know, for home brewing, and I've raised this, you know, kind of a couple of times with on the Reddit forum, which, you know, kind of led me here, is with the dose rate. The dose rate of these products with, you know, your kettle fining, if you're using a Whirlflock, which is, you know, the other guy's one, or if you use our one, which is called Protoflock, you know, similar kind of thing, or if you're using Isinglass or you're using the silicon one, I think the most common error that most home brewers are likely to make is with an over application of the dose rate. Because the actual dose rate is so low. So the carrageenan, which you're putting in at the last few minutes of the boil, there was some discussion whether it was, you know, 10 minutes or 15 minutes. That doesn't really make a difference. But it's not a tablet for a 5 gallon batch. I can tell you for our one, and I'm, you know, I'm fairly sure for the other guys, you know, if they want to disagree with me, you know, I'll recall it. But, you know, I think that tablet is probably was designed for 100 liters, which is what we call a hectoliter, or it was designed for a US brewing barrel, which is 117 liters. So, you know, so when I brew, I put in like 1/5 of one of those tablets. And I literally, I'm taking like one tablet out of a box that has 10,000 in it, you know, because that's my, that's, you know, that's the box I opened for, you know, for samples. And I'm a Scotsman, so I'm thrifty. So I save that 4/5 of a tablet in a bag and save it for next time. Because I don't want to take any of the 9,999. You know, when you, you know, flocculate out, if it's the protein in the fermenter or kettle with the carrageenan, or whether it's you're fermenting out the yeast in the fermenter, the end of fermentation, the process is kind of the same. You're using these kind of polymers, you know, these long molecules with charges on them. Light charges repel. The only way for them not to repel is to kind of neutralize them. See, the dose rate that you add needs to be in line with the amount of stuff that you're removing. So if you go too far beyond, you've got, you know, this excess of these big long molecules which don't want to nest with one another because they've got all these opposing charges, and you get this like this bulky sediment. They tend to be, you know, the bulky sediment will increase quite a lot with, you know, a really superficial kind of change at a kind of homebrew level. You know, with the, you know, with the tablets, it's like, I think it's about 0.5 gram, and they tend to, you know, the tablets are about like 2.5 grams each. You know, so it's a quarter, a fifth, about that. I'd say with home brewing, you're better going a little bit under an optimized application rate. Most of the time, what I do with, you know, with my job is I visit breweries and I will do these trials, these assays, and I'm gauging whether they should be putting in 2 grams per 100 liters or 3 grams per 100 liters or 4 grams per 100 liters. And occasionally you'll do, you know, some either side, and it's that much difference. And I've made mistakes, you know, or I've gauged it wrong by like a gram in 100 liters, and, you know, breweries will lose like hundreds of thousands of gallons. So if you're home brewing, you know, the same rules apply, that, you know, just be vigilant. You know, don't ever think that, you know, if one tablet does, you know, didn't quite do it, you know, last time, so next time you're going to put in two. It may be the opposite way around. It may be that you put in half or a quarter next time rather than in one.
And then what type, just quick question for you. Do you sell any type of finings that are for the homebrew level?
No, yeah, no, it's on the trajectory. We mostly supply to, you know, to commercial breweries, you know, from some of the big guys down to the brew pubs. It's a wonderful market. You know, I'm really wanting to access it. You know, we work with BSG. They do have, you know, they've got a homebrew wing. Their hops are fantastic. They package the hops, they develop them, and, you know, I've been out to turn out to Yakima and, you know, kind of rubbed them. So yeah, watch this space. I mean, the other, I think the one I get most interest from, which we can maybe chat about next time, is with an enzyme, not so much a finding agent, it's an enzyme called ALDC. Which, you know, there's this phenomenon called dry hop creep. Yep. You know, kind of learned a lot about it. So yeah, there's some interest there, and it's just kind of, it's working with you know, kind of partners who excel in kind of packaging down to that size.
Yeah, and just for listeners, you know, I am gonna link to like some silica findings that are for a homebrew scale in the show notes, mm-hmm. just so that like, hey, if you want to test out some of these types of findings, you can check them out. I don't know, is isinglass even something you can buy for a homebrew level? I've never seen it, so
I've seen it. I think, you know, it wasn't our stuff. I know the names of the guys that make it. It was packaged for, I think it was packaged for wine. It will work in beer. It doesn't work so well in cider. The pH drops too low. But it's available. Yeah, I can, you know, put my email up on the website. If anyone wants it, you know, I don't know how many listeners you've got. I can help you source it. Happy to supply it. Yeah. Answer any questions. You know, although we don't manage to get much out to the homebrew market, you guys are my flock, you know, and I just want to see good beer being made, and all these products will work to a certain extent, you know, if they're applied correctly. Give me a call, give me a shout. I can, you know, try and help you out. You know, I just want to see.
Yeah, well, and homebrew clubs obviously can buy, you know, larger packages of findings as well, and split them amongst the club. We personally at my homebrew club do a similar thing where we, you know, we'll buy like full liter bottles of certain findings and split them up, and we'll, you know, like we'll buy a bunch of biofine and we'll split it up, right? So that's definitely something that we do as a club. And mm-hmm. so also, yeah, I'll definitely get your contact information and we'll put that in the show notes. So if anybody has any questions about any of these types of products, you know, ask a finding expert. He can tell you about it. You guys do other stuff too, that not just findings. You guys have
sorts. Yeah, I mean, yeah. With you know, there's 2,000 odd breweries in the UK, and you know, 7,000 in the USA, 40 different countries around the world, and you know, we were the company from, you know, 100 years ago, 70 years ago, 50 years ago. If you were an oddball brewery that had a way of doing things, and you needed a specialty chemical blended to your way, we made it for you. And you know, we've continued to make it for 80 years. So there's bespoke formulations, China clay. You know, if you go to, you know, like New Glarus Brewing in Wisconsin, you can see China clay painted on the side of his open fermenters. I know Chino was talking about that last time. You know, that's our China clay. You know, if you are a Yorkshire Square brewer and your yeast is having a problem, you know, flocculating to the top, so you can skim it for the next batch, we make a product called Alcatase that you will throw in, and that will cause the yeast to flocculate to the top, and you can skim it to put in the beer. Cork mats, which the draymen like to use in the UK to drop the barrels onto, because you know bags filled with corks that, you know, you would normally see in a wine bottom, give them the correct amount of bounce that they like for dropping casks onto. We make those. It's a curious place. Long back catalog. You know, a lot of the stuff isn't in our kind of in our brochure, but you know, we continue to make it for 100 years.
That's just awesome. And hey, it's been a long pandemic. What have you made? What kind of beers have you made, and what are you enjoying these days?
Yeah, so we work with Lallemand a little bit. They released some new yeast. So what did I try out? I bought two freezers. So I tried out, I did a 3470 versus the Lallemand Diamond Lager yeast. I used the Greek. I tried the Philly Sour. I'm not too big a sour fan. I think I don't know how many of the listeners are familiar with, you know, you want to experiment, but, you know, you end up with 5 gallons or something and it's got to go somewhere. A really good oatmeal stout. I lived for a while in New Zealand. I spent a lot of time trying to, like, replicate a New Zealand lager called Emerson's I'd tried over there. You know, using some of these kind of New Zealand hops, it was for me, you know, from trying to remember a beer from 8 years ago, a lot of time doing that. I think what I had lined up was, I think, like a red ale for around about here. But yeah, just, yeah, finding the time and, you know, the ability to get through it all.
Hey, it's that is a you know, having too much beer is a good problem to have, but that's, you know, that's why you could always make 1 gallon batches. I did a whole show on it.
Especially, and, I think that this came up in the Reddit forum. If you're doing a 1 gallon batch, you know, it's like 0.05 grams of a fining agent. And I'd made the exact same mistake that this guy had, because I worked in a brewery and we were doing like R&D. You know, you can't see me, but I'm putting, like, you know, the inverted kind of comma up in the air signal, which was me bringing in my, like, electric tea urn, which you could electric boiling is more popular in the UK because we've got 240 volts, and, you know, I drew off some work to boil with some different hops. And went over to this package of findings and took out, you know, what I thought was the correct amount. It was like a handful, and threw it in, and cooled it down. And, you know, I made a jelly. So yeah, absolutely. If you're doing like a 1 gallon batch, I don't know if you mentioned this in the, you know, the presentation. Yeah, be very careful. Don't add the same amount, thinking it's going to give the same effect. Yeah, you want to go real low. Do a calculation.
Yeah, you gotta scale up. It's like,
yeah. I know you live in Colorado, so they same as me here in Massachusetts now, that you can buy an accurate, like, scale that will go to 0.01 of a gram at the gas station. You know, there's benefits there. They're easy to come by. So.
Yeah, you know, those legal states, they just have scales all over. But it's funny is I have a scale that goes to, like, I think, you know, 4 zeros. I have a really, really fine one that I bought from China for $10 off of AliExpress. And I bought it specifically to do my brewing salts, right? I only needed 1/100 of a gram, but I ended up at, you know, like, you know, 1/10,000 of a gram. But it works great, and, you know, it was $10 on a Chinese website, and that's also another, you know, if you need to get that small, you're doing a 1 gallon batch and you need to weigh out your findings specifically to a 1 gallon batch, or even hops, right, for a 1 gallon batch, can get into way less than a gram. And so you have to kind of think that way in those 1 gallon batches. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I kind of rebounded. I don't want to get too far off topic, but I spent a while trying to brew almost by, like, you know, sense of smell or something like that, barely using anything. When I first moved over, I was broke. I didn't have much equipment. It changed now, and now, you know, really started to tighten up. You know, I could probably talk for a lot longer, but yeah, got things, you know, a pH meter, and, you know, good kind of, you know, saccharometer, and you can take a bit of workbench, and I can put my laptop, and I use Brewsmith, and, you know, remembering when, you know, because I'd learned all the calculations at school, I used to do everything, you know, quite literally back of the envelope, and then, you know, lose the envelope. Yeah, and I'm a, you know, diploma brewer, you know, it was kind of hardly set an example, but yeah, I really kind of tightened up, and, you know, got scales and the correct measuring equipment, and it has really shown. You know, I'm kind of quite pleased with the results now.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we think about making great, the difference between good beer and great consistent beer is all process, right? And so I think that's and you know, to me, it's like the batches where I don't take pH readings, and I cut shortcuts. Don't get me wrong, they generally turn out and they're fine, but it's something where if you really put all of the work into it and you don't cut corners and you make sure all your numbers are right and every you really focus on process, those are the beers that end up being my best beers, right? And maybe it's because I put in all that process and it's just my brain thinking it's the best beer. But on the other hand, those also end up usually being my competition beers, and those are the beers that end up, you know, winning medals. So it's, to me, that's the process, right? It's all process.
Yeah. I've never entered a brewing competition. I kind of realized I got a degree in brewing. So if I win, people are going to think I'm a, you know, I'm a dick, you know. If I lose, people are like, yeah, oh, this guy's got a brewing degree, he didn't win, he's a dick, you know. Yeah.
You could always judge, man. You could always judge.
Yeah, I've done a few of those. I've judged competitions, and then I get pulled up, you know, by my wife about it. She you know, we're, you know, you'd be at, you know, friends, neighbors' brunch or something like that. She's like, Jamie, he went to Mexico City and judged a beer competition. That's his work. And I'm like, it is work. It's after a heavy day of, you know, kind of like judging. It's really, you know, it's a slog. And everyone in the room is laughing. And it's work. And I've enjoyed it.
It is work. You're talking to a crowd that understands that it is work. I mean, come on.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, we all
I need
get
to go
it
to brunch at your house.
It is work. I mean, imagine having, like, let's say you go and you're judging a brewing competition with 500 or 600 different beers in it, and you've got to do, you know, five or six different categories in it, and you've got to taste all the beers in those categories, and you got to try to make it so that your mouth isn't burnt out, and you want to give good feedback on every single beer. It's a lot of work.
It's a good feedback, yeah. Because I mean, the ones I've done, I've not done too many, but you know, it tends to be in like Latin America, and they just want to learn and grow. They don't mind that, you know, they're not winning. But they want the feedback, and yeah, after 500 beers, trying to figure out a new way to describe beer foam. Yeah, I care about you just as much as the number one. I'm trying to do it, but I don't want to just recite. But I've got like, you know, limited capacity to describe, you know, beer foam. But yeah, you know, enjoy it. You know, want to give everyone my best.
Awesome. Well, Jamie, I want to thank you for taking the time to be on Homebrewing DIY. This was a very fun conversation. I know that it's like, hey, we're going to talk about findings, but in the end, you're a great storyteller, and I love hearing about your brewing experience and what you're doing. And I thought it was a wonderful conversation. I will put Jamie's contact information for work over at Murphy and Son into the show notes, so that if anybody has any questions, please reach out to him. I'm sure he would love to let you know and help in any way to, you know, it's all about making great beer. And thank you for coming on Homebrewing DIY.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Yeah, let's do it again sometime.
Oh, absolutely. I'm already thinking of all the shows I'm going to have you on. I'd like to thank Jamie for coming on this week's show. It was a great conversation and really just fun to talk to him about, you know, making clear beer. It was a wonderful conversation. So thank you, Jamie. Definitely have you back. You can find us on any of the socials out there. All one word, at Homebrewing DIY. We're on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Give us a follow. I'd love to hear from you and send us feedback. I didn't have any this week, so we'll do it next week. Well, that's it for this week on Homebrewing DIY.